You're listening to the podcast between the Liminalist at horticulture.com, talking to Recluse of Vicep. As we discussed over email for the past couple of months, I think the reason I first reached out to you was because I think my wife pointed out that you were looking into some of the parapolitical deep background to Donald Trump and what's thought of as the more right wing of global politics, of geopolitics. And of course, I've looked at what's generally thought of as the left. So she was thinking there might be, you know, a way to compare notes in that regard. So that was the initial impetus. And then in our exchange, I mentioned the Fabian Society. And your initial response was that you weren't too convinced there was much fire behind that smoke, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely, after looking at your book, Vice of Kings, it's been... Because essentially, as far as the British establishment goes, most of my research is, I mean, obviously focused more on the Tories, so it's kind of interesting to see the other side of the story, so to speak, with Labour and some of the issues that were playing out. And increasingly, after, you know, really looking at the British establishment, which is, for various reasons, something I've been doing a lot of research on for the past couple of months, it really seems like there was, almost a kind of civil war being played out within the elites between the period of about 1960 or so to 1980, which was very similar to what happened here in the United States. Of course, in the States, this sort of resulted in three major deep events, the Kennedy assassination, Watergate, and then finally climaxing with the defeat of Jimmy Carter because of the October surprise, which brought Reagan to power and essentially brought a certain degree of stability again to things that had maybe been lacking for the prior two decades. And based on some of the work I've been doing, it kind of seems like something similar played out in the UK, finally climaxing with the election of Thatcher in 79.
Okay. So that would all be somewhat new to me, although I imagine it would become familiar if you unpacked it. But as you know, in Vice of Kings, I'm focusing on the earlier period. Starting with the late 1800s, I guess, with the inception of the Fabian Society, and then specifically around the 20s, 30s, and 40s, because of my grandfather's sort of peripheral involvement and all of that. But I'm curious, were you already going to be focusing on British politics anyway? Or, I mean, is that just coincidental that you ended up looking at that stuff simultaneously with me contacting you?
Well, I had been doing it for a period of time beforehand. I mean, essentially, I got into some of this research while looking into the Sokla complex, the Sokla, or the Panay Sokla, the Panay Circle, the Cinti group. It's had a lot of different names over the years, but it was created in the period of 1952 to 1953, and it was originally, I suppose, something of an auxilia of the Verberg group, but it was chiefly... principally focused initially on Franco-German rapprochement and, in general, more continental Europe. I don't know, actually, if the Americans or the British had any real involvement in the organization until the late 60s. Virtually all the major participants were French or German or, in some cases, Italians and Spaniards. And virtually all of the founding members were either members of the Knights of Malta or Opus Dei. So it seems like it was essentially a front for the Catholic establishment of Europe, or specifically a very reactionary branch of the Catholic establishment of Europe in the early years. Now, beginning in the early 70s, the British were brought into this, and the British would go on to have a rather enormous influence to the point that by the 1980s, the chairmanship of the Circle was pretty much completely controlled by the Brits, and that's the state of affairs that remains to this day. So that was kind of my first peek into the British establishment, trying to understand where some of these British Circle members were coming from and how this played into some of the political geopolitics that were playing out in the UK.
All right, so you're following, you're just following the leads as they appear. I imagine you're not really sure, or maybe even have no idea what you're likely to be researching 6 months from now, because you end up where you end up. Is that more or less accurate?
Yeah, I mean, I try to just, follow the leads where they take me, but, with the British establishment, it's something that I've been looking at for a couple of years, but I had really become a lot more interested in it in the past couple of months, and this also kind of played into another essay that I was working on for the forthcoming book that was focused on private military companies, and I hadn't really realized this, but the origins of the, modern private military companies essentially were in the UK, and it seems like the Serkna people had played a crucial role in creating this industry and have continued to have a lot of ties to it for the remaining couple of decades.
And how long have you been writing your blog?
How have I been writing my blog?
How long?
I've been doing it now since 2010, so it would be October 2010, so almost 9 years now.
And what was the initial spark that set the bonfire burning there?
I don't know if there was really necessarily one particular topic. Of course, I had been really into some of these more fringe topics like remote viewing and things of that nature. Of course, the UFO question and what have you, though I've kind of drifted away from that more in recent years, though still have a keen interest in high weirdness. It's just a topic that's really hard to find credible source material on, which is something that one of the reasons why I'm somewhat reluctant to address it now.
Right. Well, I'm tempted to bring up Prisoner Infinity at this point, but might as well save that. that's the book I wrote before Vice of Kings, and that's kind of a similar. I mean, it was motivated by a similar awareness that it's just so hard to find the signal in all the noise of ufology. So that was my attempt with Prisoner Infinity. But bring it back to my question, I mean, that's an example of Prisoner Infinity. Like, the reason I ended up writing that was because I was so personally enmeshed with Whitley Strieber. Like, I really bought into a lot of the UFO narrative, particularly around Strieber, the abduction narrative anyway, and saw more and more evidence that there was something wrong. I mean, even in my own psyche, you could say, like, having sampled the product or actually imbibed it over a long period of time, I started to observe negative effects within my own psyche, if you will, and that eventually led me to try and figure out what was going on, what were the constituents of the product that I'd been imbibing. So I'm curious with yourself, like, are you aware of there being a very personal thrust that's been driving your research, or has it been largely more sort of abstract and intellectual for you?
I do think on some level it was something of a personal thrust. Are we recording this right now, or is this just us talking?
We are, sorry. I should have warned you, the Limitless just starts as soon as we exchange hellos, we've begun, yeah.
Okay, that's fine. Well, okay, yeah, there's certain personal things that I'm really not comfortable discussing at this point, mainly because I'm still trying to make sense of all of it, but I did have two very profound experiences when I was a child, which I think might have influenced my interest in more mystical topics as I got older, but one was a dream, I guess you could say, that I had. Both of them were really dreams in a sense, but in the first one, and I know I had this when I was very, very young. I probably wouldn't have been more than 4 or 5 years old or something, but I remember just essentially being in a vast nothingness, and I, was completely, my body was completely absent. I didn't know who or what I was. I only had a sense of myself as kind of this bright light or something like that, and I became, just terribly frightened because I had no real inclination of what was going on, what I was, and gradually I started to become aware of the feeling of my body again, and based on some of my research that I've done into the occult, it seems like this is something of a experience that some people have had, this sort of sense of disembodiment and what have you, essentially your spirit leaving your body and going into kind of an unknown void, and it can be quite, traumatic, and you are severed from your physical presence, and you're not, you have no inclination of what this is and what's going on. And then dream I had, and I remember this one much more in detail. I walked into, I suppose it would be like a king's chamber or something like that. There was a throne at the back of the room, and there were lots of people in there. Essentially, a pathway had been cleared for me to the throne, and it was just a very murky setting. It was hard to see anything. It seemed like there was a lot of fog or something in the room. And I walked up to this throne where the king was sitting, and he kept asking me over and over again, "Who are you?" And I had no idea how to respond to this. And I was aware of just a physical pain striking me in my head each time I was unable to answer this question, and that was actually what had woke me up. I had a splitting headache afterwards, something with a nosebleed and what have you. It was really quite a traumatic experience, but I've heard again in some traditions that I've since researched that this is at least one interpretation of the afterlife. You are brought before something and you must explain what you are to it.
Mm, wow.
I had no idea, obviously, at the time what I was or how to answer this question. So.
Wow. Huh. Well, it's very interesting. And both of those dreams, I mean, they have a certain resonance for me. The first one, because you mentioned disembodiment and the sort of central experience of disembodiment, well, that's very central to my thesis in Prisoner Infinity, that trauma can be used and applied, obviously this is connected to mind control, to cause dissociation, and that while in a dissociated state, it's possible for us to access other realms of experience, but only at the cost of leaving our bodies behind, you know, of losing contact or full alignment with our bodies. Like, it doesn't have to be a total thing, like death would be total, right? But there's sort of levels of gradations of disembodiment, and there seems to be a correlation between increased psychism and disembodiment. And so from what I was seeing with somebody like Whitley Strieber was that his ability to access other realities and so on was inseparable from his disembodiment, you know, which was itself a symptom of trauma. And that helped see something in my own life that I had not been aware of, you know, to trace that back, even to specific trauma events, although I haven't really been able to formulate the events per se. And the other thing is this question of who am I, because that's kind of, I suppose, what I was getting to with my question, that if you read the first part of Vice of Kings, you'll know that it really began with an attempt to understand my brother's death. Well, actually, it began in a previous book, Seen and Not Seen, but and that was explicitly that. I wanted to understand how my brother had destroyed himself and why. But that opened up such a can of worms that led to part one of Vice of Kings, Occult Yorkshire. That was because as soon as I started following the logical leads, which was my brother's association with a murderous Glaswegian criminal who was associated with the Cray twins, Jimmy Boyle, who we met through my grandfather, and then that led me to my grandfather's deep involvement with the Fabian Society, which led to, you know, all the stuff that I mapped in Vice of Kings. So actually what really began as a very personal quest to understand myself better by understanding, you know, what had happened to my brother, led all the way into the, you know, Chapel Perilous of deep conspiracy politics. So anyway, that's why I was asking you, you know, to what extent you felt that over the time you'd discovered, you know, maybe an unconscious personal quest that you're on that makes the mapping of all these this different data just that much more compelling and much more than an intellectual pursuit.
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely, and you know, I mean, there is definitely some angles to my background that I have been considering that might, you know, I mean, give further explanation as to how I ended up in this, but it's really not something at this point that I want to discuss, because it's just, I'm trying to basically do research on this, and that the,
sure,
you know, I don't like to talk about this, like, it's effectively, so I've had a chance to more thoroughly consider some of the implications of the things that I can remember from my past from a young age. But
sure.
In case you're wondering, and I suppose other people are wondering, it's nothing sexual, at least as far as I know. As far as I know, I was never abused in any way as a child.
It's interesting because I don't know if you follow the work of Chris Knowles, but in the last couple of years, he's begun to, outright state that he thinks that he was embedded as a child in. I mean, of course, we're all embedded in the culture. That's what becomes more and more plain. But again, there are gradations, and from what I've read and heard of Chris Knowles, he's definitely accepted that he himself was somehow deeply impacted by these programs that he's been uncovering for so many years, but I don't think he either has gone into any detail. I think it is. I mean, it's a line to cross with great caution for sure.
Well, yes, I mean, certainly, and I mean, it's just, to me, I mean, it's almost incredible some of the implications of it, but I mean, it does kind of play into the, murky background I have with my father. My father was a military officer in the 50s. I have been told by many years that he had been in special forces, the Green Berets, by my mother, but after getting a hold of his military transcripts, this did not, I didn't really see a lot of indications that he had been in special forces, though I still have about a year that's unaccounted for. But he had been stationed to Fort Meade, which is, of course, the home of the National Security Agency, and he had also been dispatched to Greenland at one point where he had worked at a listening post there. So it seems rather evident to me that he was involved in some kind of signals intelligence. So certainly I do think that he was a military intelligence officer, and that does raise some interesting implications. But again, I haven't really thoroughly researched these angles to my satisfaction to the point that I really want to talk about them.
Sure. Are your parents still alive?
Yeah, my mom is. My father passed away in 2013. My father never liked to talk about his time in the military, so I never, really got a chance to talk to him about a lot of these topics, though, as I've noted in several of the other interviews I've done over this, my father had quite a conspiratorial worldview. I can remember listening to William Cooper with him actually when I was, gosh, probably 12 or 13 years old when we were vacationing in Colorado. My mother is still alive, and I am not in speaking terms with her.
So that's interesting about your father's interest. So was he was interested in UFOs then?
No, I don't believe he ever really. This would have been, I think, after Cooper himself had started to move away from UFOlogy, which was in the early 90s, and got into more conventional, I guess, quote unquote, conspiracy theories, or more in line with like the John Birch Society types of conspiracy theories that have been prevalent in the United States since the late 50s.
Right. So, but your father introduced you to to the field that you've ended up dedicating so much of your time to.
Yes. I would say that, yes, he was the one who had kind of inadvertently introduced me to this world. There was also another book that he was quite obsessed with, too. The name escapes me now, off the top of my head. The Rich and the Super Rich, which was another, I believe that was what it was called, but that was kind of an early effort, I think, to really chronicle American high society. It's, ties to the U.S. intelligence community and things like that. But it's quite a scandalous book, if I remember correctly, when it was released in the 1950s. He had a very old copy of it that I know he had read quite a few times. And the young child, I know he tried to, introduce me to some of this stuff, but at the time I thought it was rather stuffy.
Wow, it's ironic. I mean, because it's actually quite, pretty unconventional anyway, quite edgy to have a father who's. Do you think he was trying to educate you or prepare you in some way for for an aspect of reality that he was aware of, that he wanted you to be aware of?
I think in some sense, yes. I mean, I don't, know that he really had a lot of privy information necessarily about how the intelligence community operated or something like that, but he was certainly aware that there was, I mean, a kind of shadow government that ruled the country. I'm sure that he had been convinced of this for a very long time. And I mean, over the years, he had been kind of in his own way involved in a lot of arcane research. In fact, I seem to remember, I think this was at the late 60s or something like that, he had actually been put on a watch list. He was aware of this because one of the sheriff, I believe one of the sheriff's deputies in the area of West Virginia that my family's from, come to essentially tell him that he had been informed by sources from above that he needed to keep an eye on him. So,
And was he, did you share your blog with him while he was alive?
No, I didn't. I did show him some of my other political writings, but at the time, especially, my blog was more geared towards supernatural elements. And like I said, he really had no interest in UFOs or any of those type of things, and I don't know if he really would have known what to make of some of the, you know, more occultic research and things of that nature.
Hmm. So that's been your trajectory then. You've started out with Fortean and paranormal and the occult, and have just gradually graduated more and more to socio-political stuff.
Well, and on top of that too, I mean, I've always, I would say, had an interest in extreme cultures, if you will. Of course, going back to when I was in middle school, going into early high school, I really started to get into horror movies and the horror genre in general, and you know, I mean, I watched a lot of the stuff, you know, obsessively, read a lot of the books and the directors like John Carpenter and Wes Craven and so on and so forth. And then later I got into heavy metal, and specifically the what was left really of the death metal scene in Florida at the time. Of course, I don't know if you're aware of this, but Tampa, Florida was considered one of the major hubs for the rise of death metal in the 90s, and quite a few of the metalheads I ended up hanging out with had been strongly influenced by this scene. And I personally do not like death metal. I've never really enjoyed any of the music that they were into, in all honesty, but I found the people who were affiliated with this very interesting. Of course, in and of itself, how people would want to be involved in such a scene in the first place is kind of a curiosity. So I kind of think that this might have been one of the reasons why, especially the type of research that I, you know, deal with, which is especially centered around Nazism and fascism, had a certain appeal to me. So obviously a lot of people who, you know, go down these roads are not as interested in this really kind of far-right ideology as I've become. But again, I think that might have been partly due to the fact that I've always been fascinated by these really extreme cultures in general and what, you know, attracts people to them.
Right. So you're kind of mapping a developmental curve or interest curve anyway, from horror movies through heavy metal to right-wing conspiracy and stuff, but also occultism in there. I mean, at what point were you interested in occultism, when you were younger or only when you started researching?
I mean, to some extent, I mean, when I was hanging out with the metalheads and what have you, I think that was around the time that I had bought my first Crowley book and what have you. But honestly, nobody in the, you know, metal scene really knew anything about occultism, even the self-described Satanists. So I was typically the smartest man in the room in that regard. I really didn't know anything at that point in time either. But I do think that at least in the early years, listening to heavy metal, this is what sort of exposed me to Crowley, at least, and the Church of Satan and some of these other topics that I've later, you know, become interested in.
Hmm. Well, I was going to ask about this, and I mean, I guess I'll just go ahead, but if it's not a fruitful line of procedure, then we can just back up. But what was occurring to me was the ways in which culture can serve to prime us later on in life. So, like horror movies and heavy metal, even, you know, all kinds of different musical genres, actually, they tend, my impression is that they tend to prime us, as I say, for an interest in the occult, and that this might even be deliberate to some degree, or consciously implemented as a way, you know, you, like the Jesuit thing, get the child and you make the man. So if the culture introduces us to certain values and symbols and imagery and whatnot very young, and we associate that with you know, fantasy that empowers us in a difficult time, adolescence and whatnot, then we're much more likely to gravitate to that in a much more serious way when we're adults.
Are you asking me, like, would I agree with that statement?
Yeah, whether that's been part of your research, has that included looking at it at that level in terms of the sort of subtler ways in which social engineering can shape our identities and our values? Is that part of your interest?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that to some extent. I mean, I definitely, you know, witnessed that with the heavy metal scene that I was a part of in Florida. again, I don't know that really any of the people involved in this really developed a truly keen interest in the occult. But certainly some of these individuals, especially as they got older, did do some pretty extreme things to kind of uphold the metal lifestyle, if you will, or at least the death metal lifestyle. In particular, I can think of one individual who actually desecrated a grave, dug up the corpse, and took the skull out of the casket. Later ended up as on his end table, essentially, at his house. Wow. The ornament there. But certainly, but I think, to me at least, more interesting was really the proliferation of right-wing politics and the metal scene in hindsight that was really curious to me, because generally speaking, you don't, you know, think of these types of movements as being especially conservative, but this really wasn't the case with the metalheads that I was experienced, you know, or that I was around a lot growing up. I mean, quite a few of these people had rather racist and homophobic views on a lot of things, and at this time, this was also when the black metal scene, or specifically the Norwegian black metal scene, had really started to gain a lot of notoriety because of the church burnings over there, and Varg Vigernes had really become something of a cult figure within the heavy metal community, and I think that was an access point for a lot of people into some of these more extreme politics. But I do find it interesting that a lot of these people have actually grown up to become really diehard Trump supporters in recent years.
Well, so let's get to that nub then of right and left, because I have a problem with the terminology at this point, as in, I mean, I'm not quite sure how to tell the difference between right and left. I think it's probably pretty obvious, maybe in terms of just ordinary individuals who have different values and different attitudes towards specific subjects, like homosexuality is an obvious one, and we kind of associate the differing or the opposing perspectives with right and left, and so on, right, around specific things. But in terms of actual groups and agendas and even ideologies, I find it difficult in the sense that they seem to overlap in so many ways. So, for example, the Vice of Kings, it's the first part is about Fabian Society, who is absolutely, you know, is Marx even. It's like a sort of popularized Marxism, or whatever we're going to call that, reconfigured for British society and for Western society in general, and made, you know, more subtle and more wieldy as far as being a, you know, a tool for social engineering, let's say. But definitely one would have to identify that as a leftist kind of thing. Part two is about Aleister Crowley, who in many ways one would see as, you know, an example of the overlap between occultism and right-wing politics, I presume. And yet there's so many correlations between Crowley's value set and the Fabians, you know, the sexual progressiveness being the obvious one, and even the reification of the individual, although weirdly the Fabian thing was socialist. So there's an example of my confusion, right? So I don't know if you can help. I mean, this is not leading to a very clear question, but do you have any insights about that, or any feelings that in your own experience of trying to map this apparent socio-political polarity?
Well, I mean, for starters, I mean, I think, especially in the States and the UK to a lesser extent, but probably certainly more so in these two nations than in, say, continental Europe, I don't know if we've really had, a true left-wing movement, or certainly one that wasn't co-opted by, you know, wealthy capitalists for a number of years now.
Right.
Which I think leads to some of the confusion here. I mean, obviously there was some flirtation, I think, with social democracy amongst the elites in the U.S. and the U.K. Going into the 1930s when FDR was elected here, at least. I don't know exactly the details in British society because I'm not as familiar with that, you know, era. But essentially it seems like there was a dispute between the Morgans and the Rockefellers in this issue. The Morgans had really been the dominant power basis in the country for a number of years to that point, and they were staunchly opposed to FDR and this kind of approach to what would now be known as social democracy, whereas the Rockefellers tentatively embraced it. And I think a lot of that really just had to do out of practicality. Of course, this was the same time frame when Hitler had really consolidated his, you know, hold to, you know, alleviate the suffering of the working classes, there was a real possibility that somebody would come to power who would, you know, eventually not be under the control of the elites, and that would lead to some real changes that they didn't necessarily want, and probably most of society probably wouldn't have wanted.
Right.
So, I mean, I think to some extent, you know, you have this kind of angle where you have what has mostly been passed off as liberalism is really a perversion of it, as it would have been, I think, really understood at the turn of the 20th century as a movement that was geared towards, you know, helping the working class, the downtrodden, the oppressed, and so forth, into something that's really, you know, consolidated, and especially within, say, the Democratic Party here in the United States and Labour in the UK, a very pro-capitalist approach to liberalism, to put it mildly. And I know, I mean, I certainly found it interesting in your book that you yourself seem to have really questioned the socialism of the Fabians towards the end of it, if I, at least this was sort of the interpretation I drew from it.
In what sense questioned it?
Well, I suppose more in the sense where they truly, you know, truly progressive movement, or one that actually cared, I guess, more about the downtrodden, the working classes, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think it took me to get to the end. I mean, I was aware, even growing up, that there was some hypocrisy in my family, that there was apparent espousal of values, but they weren't being practiced or embodied. So I was skeptical from the start, but certainly I found more than enough evidence to confirm that skepticism and to more or less conclude that, yeah, the Fabian symbol is correct, that it's a wolf in sheep's clothing. They're using seemingly socialist values and liberal values as a way to consolidate their power or extend it in new ways. But the question that leaves me with is, I mean, because if we're talking, I mean, even Marx was, Marx was a member of the ruling class too, and he didn't have much time for the common man from what I've read about Marx. So then, you know, is there actually any kind of leftist political ideological set, value set, that wasn't created, you know, by the ruling class? Like, what's the counterpoint there?
That's, I mean, certainly a good question, and I mean, I don't know that I could really answer that at this point. I mean, it's not, you know, really something that I've looked into thoroughly, but I mean, I do think, though, at least for the last 100 years or so, there's obviously been, I mean, a consorted effort to really co-opt any real attempt at genuine social reform. And, I mean, it may well have gone back to the era of Marxism, though it does seem that there was a genuine apprehension to true Marxism, at least amongst the ruling elites, I mean, for quite a considerable amount of time, though that may well have been more of a dispute over essentially who would be in control of things, so to speak.
direction.
I mean, the other factor here for me is that the correlation that I map in Vice of Kings between socialist and liberal politics, progressive politics, and so on, you know, and supposedly, as you say, standing up for the minorities and all of that, with sexual liberation, and even, I mean, very explicitly and consistently, this idea that in order to liberate people from patriarchal oppression, they have to be liberated from sexual shame or sexual neurosis, and to do this, you know, we have to have sex with children. That idea seems to have been very consistent throughout these different social reform programs, and of course that's obviously a big red flag, because it overlaps with I mean, not only is it probably wrong, and probably 100% wrong, but it also overlaps with just purely exploitational and even malevolent agendas, you know, to traumatize children.
Yes, no, I mean, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, of course, though, there seems to have been somewhat different approaches to this within, I mean, different occult circles. I mean, you certainly made some compelling arguments in the case that this was something that Crowley, for instance, would have advocated. But I'm, of course, very keenly interested in Julius Evola, the Italian philosopher and occultist, who played such a prominent role. I shouldn't say prominent, but he was active within the Third Reich, and especially their intelligence community there. But I was really curious because, I mean, or interested in this because, I mean, Evola really seems to, despite the fact that he really based a lot of his ideology on the same materials as Crowley, came to a very different philosophical standpoint. Mm. On the one hand, Evola essentially saw, he was extremely influenced by Hinduism, I should probably preface by saying, and the caste systems and so forth, but essentially his worldview was geared towards this notion that in the very earliest days, the purest religion had been a patriarchal solar cult, essentially, that had been withheld by the warrior caste in the ancient Indo-Aryan civilization, and the perversion of spirituality had begun with the rise of the Brahmin caste, the priestly caste, which had taken things in more of a matriarchal direction. And to this end, unlike a lot of Western occultists, Evola absolutely despised the mystery cults of antiquity. He saw them as complete manifestation of the matriarchal principles and essentially a kind of corrupting influence on society as a whole. And this led to, you know, I mean, some very different perspectives than what Crowley would have had. For instance, I mean, Evola was utterly appalled by homosexuality, and this seems to have been a notion that was picked up by quite a few of his followers. Of course, he did have a considerable influence on the New Right in France. One of the more notorious members of it, I can't remember his first name. His last name was Venner, and he gained notoriety, I believe, in 2013, 2014, when he walked into the Cathedral of Notre Dame and shot himself in the head out of protest for France recently legalizing gay marriage.
Wow.
So there definitely, you know, were a different perspective in some sections of these kind of occult philosophers on how, you know, these issues should be addressed to the public. Now, that being said, there definitely are compelling indications that Evola may well have advocated the abuse of children. Certainly within some of his magical writings, there are references to the sacred rape of virgins and that type of thing, which could certainly be interpreted as that. But Evola and his followers, I don't think in any way, shape, or form would have ever wanted the general public to know that these, you know, types of actions were going on, whereas it seems like in a lot of ways Crowley almost flaunted it to a certain extent.
Hmm. just lingering on that Notre Dame incident for a moment, because of Notre Dame recently catching fire, it obviously got my attention. Do you think that was an intentional reference to matriarchy that he chose Notre Dame?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, too, because Venner, the Frenchman who had committed suicide there, his birthday was actually the same day that the Notre Dame fire burned down this year.
Oh, wow.
I think that the powers that be, or at least I should say the liberal globalist faction, may well have pushed for the fire in some way or other.
Mm.
But, I mean, it does make me wonder, well, are they really in control of the forces that this has unleashed? Because, I mean, obviously in the years prior to this, the cathedral had actually become a very potent symbol for the rights in France. And it already seems like a lot of outrage has been spurred amongst the Yellow Vest movement over the proposal essentially to recreate this as a secular temple. So I don't know that, you know, it's going to have the effect that maybe some of the people were hoping that it would, and then it's kind of further complicated by the fact that Venner, even though he had, expressed admiration for Christian civilization, he was himself a pagan, as were many of these other, you know, members of the New Right in France. So, in a way, I mean, it could be seen as an event that may trigger some kind of pagan imperium at some point.
Hmm. So I was just going to ask a big picture question now, which generally I try and avoid, but I feel as though we've kind of inexorably led there. Is your perspective over the years, has it been or has it become, I mean, in very simplified terms, that there are two main factions warring behind the scenes of global politics, or is that just a gross oversimplification of what you see?
Yes, I mean, I think roughly speaking, there are, you know, different factions. I don't know if it's necessarily two factions, but I do definitely feel on many levels, I mean, there is a dispute over the direction that they want the, you know, world to go in at this point.
Right. So where my mind goes, of course, is, as I say, of course, maybe it's not obvious, but is that, you know, in terms of global political theatre, or, you know, the level that I personally consider theatre, say Hillary versus Trump, or who's actually getting into office as the puppet figures and so on. I mean, maybe you're going to disagree with this, but my sense, and also what I assume about with the, what I was mapping with the left and right in British politics, it became more and more apparent to me, but also I think to British people over the generations, that the Labour and the Conservative weren't really that different, that it was a bit of a Coke and Pepsi swindle for the sake of theatre. And so then you've got this cryptocracy behind both the left and the right, at a superficial level, that are really benefiting from this divide and conquer theatre. Well, it's both theatre and real, because they're dividing the people, but the terms of the different political parties, it's not a real thing. It's divide. It's an appearance of division, but actually a secret unification, so that, you know, whoever comes into power, the same policies are getting pushed, just with a different hand, the left or right. So then my question is, and of course you might disagree with that summation, and you're welcome to, but if insofar as you do agree, have you considered that could even be true at an even higher level, that the apparent factions that are vying for power behind the scenes might be unaware that there's another power behind them that's benefiting from this struggle?
Well, I mean, certainly you can't really discount the fact that there is some kind of, you know, meta group that's at the, you know, pinnacle of all of this.
Mm.
But I mean, on the flip side of the coin, there does seem to be some real, you know, genuine debates on certain issues. I mean, in terms of, you know, foreign policy more recently in the United States, I do think there's legitimate debates among the intelligence and, you know, security establishment. Was Russia a greater threat? Is China a greater threat? And I mean, it also, I think, to some extent, when you go even further, it brings into the question, what about these, you know, other countries? Are the Russian elites part of this group? Are the Chinese elites part of this group? Do they all have a uniform agenda? Or is there, you know, I mean, a lot of infighting and a lot of subterfuge that are being performed by them? I mean, certainly with the rise of a lot of the BRIC countries, if you will, Russia, China, India, and so on and so forth, I do think there's a legitimate question as to whether or not these countries want to continue, you know, playing second fiddle to the United States and Europe in some kind of global border, and I do think there's, you know, a real dispute over that at this point right now that we, the public, aren't really privy to.
Sure. Well, it makes me think that there may be an experimental element to all of this, as in there could be factions or a faction or whatever that isn't directly involved in the conflict. I guess it's kind of the thing, you know, just waiting in the wings to pick up the pieces. So it can allow a certain amount of geopolitical freedom to this or that faction, because then that's a way to try out different policies and different methodologies and see who's left standing at the end of it.
Well, certainly, and I mean that's, you know, something that really interests me about, again, the rise of Ebola in recent years, because I mean it really seems like he's had a considerable degree of philosophical influence in a lot of these quote-unquote populist movements, you know, beginning with France, with Italy, within the alt-right in the States with Steve Bannon, and the I believe it's the National Front in the UK with Nick Griffin and these types of people, but then also going into the Russian establishment with I believe it's Dugin or something to that effect, who's generally described as Putin's Rasputin.
I don't
know that that's actually the case, but certainly this individual has contacts with the Russian intelligence services, and you know, apparently he did start to develop this ideology when he encountered some of Evola's writings at the library during his youth in the 1980s. So I mean, there is this sort of strange dynamic where you do have, on the one hand, this sort of traditionalist movement that has slowly grown up over the past few decades, really since the end of World War II, and has really consolidated a lot of power within various Western governments in the within Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think that is definitely one of the more interesting developments that's playing out right now.
Hmm. What's your goal, would you say? I mean, is this an open-ended project for you, just like other people kind of perhaps naively follow politics to think, you know, they want to keep up on what's going on in the world? Is this your version of that you just want to keep abreast of what the hell's going on in the world? Or do you feel as though you're mapping something that might eventually lead to a point of satisfaction that you've got it mapped, right, and that you can, you know, roll up the map and put it in your backpack and embark on, you know, exploring the territory, as in navigating whatever point we're at in history? Do you feel as though this is an open-ended project that will never end, or one that you're trying to get to a certain point of cognizance about to feel satisfied?
Well, I certainly think it's an open-ended project. I mean, for me, more than anything, I just want to understand the elites, I suppose I would say, at a level, and try to grasp, you know, why a lot of these things are happening. Mm. And I don't know, you know, I mean, obviously with the access that I have, I mean, if that's possible, really, but I mean, I'm trying the best I can to try to grasp and understand, you know, what plays into all of these different issues that are unfolding, especially in the modern era. And to also, I mean, help people who read my blog and what have you to also try to gain some enlightenment and understanding into this, you know, very closed world.
Well, one of the things that I find very refreshing about your blog and almost unique is that, and this is something I've aspired to also with my last couple of books, Prisoner Infinity and Vice of Kings, that you're very methodical in terms of just sifting through the historical data. And you know, finding the pieces that help you create a picture that reveals the hidden history, and there isn't a great deal of theorizing or speculating about, you know, what this means in terms of the big picture or the intentions or the degree of conspiracy and so on. And because the facts themselves, you know, if you stay with the facts over time, they do create a compelling and even overwhelming picture of complicity and of, you know, similar groups and similar agendas and so on and so forth.
Well, yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, I've tried to really deliberately avoid any kind of editorial commentary as much as possible in my writings for that reason, what you're kind of saying. I like to just present the facts to people and let them draw their own conclusions. I, you know, tend to think that a lot of times when people do editorialize on, you know, data that they're presenting, that's where they get into trouble. It's,
right.
And also, I mean, I would just prefer that people try to reach their own conclusions as well. I mean, I do kind of feel like in the grand scheme of things, if you want somebody to truly learn something, it's one thing to kind of give them the materials to learn it. It's another thing to tell them specifically what they want, what you want them to learn. So
right.
My thinking has always been in the sense of empowering people going into this research. It's best to let them come to their own conclusions and to hopefully use my research as a springboard for other topics that they themselves might wish to pursue.
Sure. Well, but I think that it's also a way of modeling a methodology that can help other people to develop or discover their own critical faculties. Because there's I mean, what's going on in the world now, and I wanted to maybe get to this in terms of what your view is of other researchers out there, but a lot of people who have a sense, or even they know, they've discovered or whatever, that something isn't right with the world and that there's all kinds of manipulations going on behind the scenes, they'll end up at the biggest trough, you know. They'll just go into the shopping mall where they can get all the stuff they think they want. So they'll end up at InfoWars or DavidIke.com or, you know, a couple of levels above that. But still, there's, you know, it's still conspiratainment. It's still chunking up. It's still oversimplifying to make it palatable. And I don't know if that stuff is doing a service to anyone. So I think when they come to a site like yours, I think it provides a kind of bridge, because it's clear that you are referring to official history, and you are referring, I would say, even primarily to kind of mainstream sources or just your own research. But it's also clear that you're not dismissive of, I mean, you might be dismissive of Alex Jones or David Icke. I mean, I would be too, but I don't get the impression you would be dismissive of any particular possible interpretation, except so far as, well, I don't see the evidence for it, if you know what I mean. I mean, there seems to be an openness to your approach.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's really my, you know, criteria. I mean, can you present evidence to me that's credible for a certain theory or not? And in the case of a lot of stuff like Alex Jones, I mean, you know, it really falls apart if you start looking at some of his allegations. And, of course, most of Jones's, you know, ideology in and of itself can be traced back to the John Birch Society, an organization I mentioned earlier. And the John Birch Society was essentially, you know, set up by the Pentagon in the late 50s, early 60s, I think, to disseminate kind of propaganda, I should say, against the Eastern establishment for their own agendas. So Essentially a lot of this ideology is in of itself, you know, originates from disinformation that was disseminated for decades in this country. And that's really true of most of the conspiracy strands in the United States in general. I can't really weigh in on the British ones, but I mean, very much it's been a controlled opposition movement for decades now.
Yeah. And seems to be becoming more obvious in terms of becoming more mainstream and more popularized, and I guess having more real world manifestations. I mean, a lot of people who are behind Donald Trump are so because their conspiracy mindset has led them to believe that he's actually the only man that could make a difference, you know.
Oh yeah, no, it's truly bizarre that you're seeing a figure like Alex Jones, who's, you know, become a major cheerleader for Trump. And I mean, clearly Trump must value Jones's abilities to, you know, hype him up, because I mean, he appeared on his show, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
It's just, you know, I mean, it's really unbelievable to even see some of this stuff happening right now.
Yeah, I agree. And it almost seems like the flip side of Obama was, Obama was baffling me that people who I thought should know better were actually buying into the hype around Obama, that somehow this was going to be a different president. And they did. And then, of course, you know, it turned out, well, whatever, what should have been obvious from the start, that it was the same agendas being pushed by a different figurehead. But then with Trump, it seems to be the next level, which is people who think that they do know better, falling for it again in a different way, as in falling for the idea that somehow this is a wild card that's been thrown, or a spanner that's been thrown in the works, and that he wasn't supposed to get back, you know, he wasn't supposed to get into office. And that, you know, the fact that he does just shows that actually there's a monkey wrench in the system, and so on and so forth. So I don't know what you think about that. I mean, it does seem as though there was some confusion around who was going to be in power. So I think there's some credibility to that point of view. It's just that when it's taken to the extreme that Trump actually is an outsider who somehow muscled his way in, that just is crazy at that point, no?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as best I can tell, I mean, I think within the elite, the controversy over Trump really goes back to reforms that were done to the U.S. intelligence community during the Bush 2 years, and specifically that were really driven by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. But essentially, Rumsfeld and also Cheney, for that matter, as they generally worked very close together in a lot of these reforms. But on the one hand, they were very dubious of the Pentagon hierarchy. Of course, most of the generals, when they took over, had you know, cut their teeth in Vietnam. They had witnessed the, you know, gross unpopularity of the U.S. military after Vietnam, and as such, were generally very reluctant to embark upon any kind of, you know, combat, because they were essentially terrified of the PR fallout. So on the other hand, you had the CIA, and essentially Rumsfeld and Cheney thought that the CIA had gotten a little soft, that they were no longer, that they no longer possessed the testicular fortitude for what needed to be done. And to essentially bypass these two entities, they really pumped up what is known as the Joint Special Operations Command. And the Joint Special Operations Command essentially coordinates all of the elite special operations forces geared towards counterinsurgency and counterterrorism. This would be the Delta Force, this would be SEAL Team 6, and so on and so forth. And in this capacity, on the one hand, they transferred a lot of human intelligence to JSOC. And this was a big move because, generally speaking, the CIA had done all of this kind of stuff in terms of placing spies in, you know, foreign countries and what have you. And then on top of that, they also transferred a lot of the covert operation capabilities to JSOC. And that was even a more of a profound move because the CIA essentially had had a complete monopoly on covert operations, essentially since its creation going throughout the Cold War. And now you had these Special Operations Forces people who were doing their own covert operations, placing their own spies in foreign countries and so on and so forth, that the CIA had no real control over. And the end result of this is that there was a phenomenal rise in the power of a lot of these Special Operations Forces that was really unprecedented in the history of this country. I mean, up to this point, on the one hand, the military hierarchy had never been comfortable with them. The first special special operations forces were the Army Special Forces, the Green Berets, and they were essentially created in the 1950s to be the paramilitary arm of the CIA. And as such, the military was, you know, very antagonistic towards them for many years. So there was no real place for advancement beyond a certain point in the military for special operations forces. And as such, a lot of them hoped to go into the CIA, but then the CIA's covert actions capabilities had really been hindered after the fallout from Watergate and then later from Iran-Contra and so on and so forth. But then, I mean, Rumsfeld and Cheney came along, and now, you know, you had people who would only advance upon past a certain point who are now in control of the Army, who were in control of, Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, which is one of the most senior military or intelligence figures now in the United States deep state, and it's never really talked about. And this brought a group of individuals essentially into the upper hierarchy of power who were really, I think, different from those that had come before them. Obviously, I mean, being a member of the Delta Force is, it's a little different than being an intelligence analyst at the CIA, let's put it that way.
Right.
So I think that's really at the heart of a lot of these problems right now. I mean, you look at some of the really, you know, adamant anti-Trump factions within the deep state, like John Brennan, the former CIA director, and James Clapper. These were both individuals who had staunchly opposed the rise of JSOC for years leading up to Trump's election. And then on the flip side of the coin, a lot of Trump's allies are very closely tied to JSOC. Of course, there was Michael Flynn, his national security advisor. Flynn had actually overseen intelligence for JSOC during the past decade. You had William Boykin. Boykin's not actually in the administration, but he's been a big Trump backer. Boykin had overseen JSOC. There was Eric Prince. Prince had been a Navy SEAL. He had later done contract work for JSOC after he had founded Blackwater and so on and so forth. And then there's also Keith Kellogg, who might be Trump's most prominent national security advisor. Certainly he's been kind of stealthily hidden away from the anti-Trump factions in various positions in the administration for the past few years now. But Kellogg had overseen Joint Special Operations commanding Europe. He had been a Green Beret in the Vietnam era. And I think that was something that was very concerning to people like Brennan and Clapper. I mean, Brennan, of course, was an intelligence analyst. This is where, he had cut his teeth in CIA before moving up to more prestigious postings, and Clapper was involved in signals intelligence. So, I mean, neither of these men were, they were essentially desk jockeys, more or less, if you want to get down to it. And this was stark contrast to guys like Flynn and Boykin. I mean, these were, men who had been out in dangerous combat situations who almost surely killed other people in this, in these circumstances. So I think there's a certain degree of contempt that a lot of the Trump backers within the national security establishment have for people like Brennan and Clapper, and that's, probably a driving factor behind this rift.
Interesting. Do you see the sort of mainstream media attempts to blacken Trump or disparage him and even to impeach him? I mean, there are sort of callings for impeachment and all of this stuff. Do you see that? How do you see that? Like, is it a genuine attempt to get Trump out of power, or is it an attempt to just stir up kind of schismogenesis, to split the collective and just stir up the tensions within the populace, or do you see it as both?
I think that there is a genuine attempt to get Trump out of office, and another point that I've kind of written on recently, too, is, I think on some levels a lot of this dispute is very personal. Flynn, his former NSA advisor, was actually drummed out of the Defense Intelligence Agency when he was the director by Clapper. Boykin had also been drummed out of the office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence by Clapper. And then, of course, Trump himself, one of the instances that's kind of cited for his reason to, for his decision to run in the first place was the White House Correspondents' Dinner, I think, from, 2011, 2012, somewhere thereabouts, where he was essentially roasted personally by Obama and effectively humiliated in front of a lot of these VIPs by him. So, I think on some levels, Trump himself and some of his most prominent national security advisors, took some of the things that were done during the Obama administration very, very personally. And then you kind of add on top of that the fact that Trump was a protege of Roy Cohn. And Cohn was just, a pivotal figure, it seems like, in the deep state. And more to the point, Cohn also seems to have been a very feared figure. Generally speaking, individuals who crossed Cohn did not, end up well in the long run, to put it mildly. So I think there's some perception that Trump is a bit of a loose cannon, maybe, because of those relationships. And just in general, he made his money in Atlantic City, which was, essentially controlled totally by the mob in this era. You failed in Atlantic City, you didn't just go bankrupt. You ended up with a bullet from a small caliber pistol in your skull and your body dumped, somewhere.
Right.
Trump, thrived in this environment, which tells me, first and foremost, Trump is a shark. He's not a community organizer. He's not, some drug-addled playboy who's the son of a former president. This is a guy who probably dealt with some very, very dangerous people firsthand, during his rise to prominence.
So it's like the Corleone family going legit, finally.
Yes, I mean, I do think to some extent, I mean, obviously there's always been this close, you know, overlap between mainstream politics and organized crime, but there was, you know, I mean, an attempt, I think, to keep it at arm's length to some extent, and now, you know, it's literally in the White House.
Right. Right, so you could see how that would be upsetting for a lot of liberal people who were believing that, you know, we were just on the verge of a politically correct utopia.
Well, I mean, I think it's even more upsetting because, I mean, a lot of these, I mean, organized crime types seem to have been at the forefront as well, I mean, of these, you know, different honey traps and things that were, you know, being carried out. And if Trump was a part of this network, I mean, and I do think he was, this raises a strong possibility that Trump probably is in possession of some of these, you know, quote-unquote control files and things of that nature.
Right.
Again, I mean, you know, Obama was basically a nobody before he was elected to the Senate. I mean, he did some things as a community organizer, but, I mean, this is very different from being groomed by somebody like Roy, you know, Cohn, who was a blackmail artist extraordinaire. I mean, it's just, it's a totally different level.
If we call them rumors, because I don't follow it closely enough, but there were people who, one of the things that they were using as evidence that Trump was different and he was actually really going to drain the swamp was that he was going after organized pedophile rings in some of the early months. Did you hear about that?
Yes, I did.
Right, so was that verifiable, and then would you relate that to what you're talking about here, that he was just using some of those files to get rid of the people that were inconvenient, or how would you interpret that?
I do think there is a distinct possibility of that, and I think you can especially, and I don't know if it's necessarily just pedophiles, but I think you can see that in what's happening with Hollywood, of course. essentially Roy Cohn's hatchet man for a lot of years, was a private detective known as Thomas Corbelly. Corbelly also would go on to work with Trump for many years after Cohn died as well. But Corbelly had a lot of ties in Hollywood. He was actually on very good terms with Robert Evans, and he was a good friend of Heidi Fleiss, the so-called Hollywood madam from the early 90s, who had provided services for quite a few Hollywood VIPs during this time frame. And now when you kind of look at some of the things that have happened in Hollywood recent years, well, Harvey Weinstein, a prominent Democrat, was laid low by the Me Too movement. Kevin Spacey, another kind of prominent Democrat, was outed as a pedophile. So certainly Corbelly would have been a guy in position to find out about a lot of this stuff. I mean, this is essentially what he made a career off of, and this was a guy that Trump had worked with. So, yeah, I mean, if Corbelly had ever mentioned some of this stuff to Trump, I could definitely see it being used as a weapon at this point.
Mm-hmm. Right, so, and you're aware of it, how in Britain, after Jimmy Savile's death, you're aware of how much was coming out in Britain over a year or two in that period?
Yes, yes, to some extent. I haven't really looked at the Savile stuff as much as I would have liked, but I do think that's going to be a point of focus on some of the research I'm doing going into the future.
Well, yes, it's a real can of worms. And I mean, one of the things that, well, it seemed there was a period after Jimmy Savile died where so much was coming to light. It was quite surreal. It was like, you know, Channel 4 News, that's the main, you know, one of the main channels in the UK, one of two main channels, three, was reporting on, you know, investigation of high-level pedophiles, and that many of them were Freemasons, and that Freemasons, police who were Freemasons, were not being allowed to be on the investigation team because of this, you know. So it was like, it was quite surreal. It was like something you'd expect to hear on Alex Jones, you were watching on mainstream news. And so there was a feeling that, you know, the institutions were starting to tremble. But, of course, it didn't continue for very long, and it's not exactly clear what happened. It wasn't as though there was an overt shutting down of investigations. I mean, they did continue. I suppose they're continuing to this day, and there have been occasional, I'm tempted to say scapegoats, but that would suggest that they were innocent. But I mean, people who are thrown to the wolves, whether it's Rolf Harris or whoever it is, probably listeners haven't even heard of Rolf Harris, but he was a children's entertainer. And there seemed to be a way to sort of pacify people that something was being done, and that without actually really getting to the bottom of the situation, because to get to the bottom of the situation would be to risk destabilizing the whole of British society, right? And not only do the controlling elite not want that for obvious reasons, but the whole population doesn't want that. Nobody wants that, right? They want to still be able to send their children to school. They don't want to think that their school is being run by pedophiles. Actually, most people would, not consciously, but I think, you know, semi-consciously, would opt not to know, because they feel there's nothing they can do about it anyway. So I think that this is, you know, why I feel that complicity is a better word than conspiracy. There's the only way that these kind of this kind of organized malevolence, talking specifically about child abuse now, but that can continue, is if there's a degree of complicity from people to you know, turn away and look away. So, you know, and I've wondered the same thing, you know, what's going on with Hollywood and Weinstein and Spacey. It's like there's this bubbling awareness that something really dark is festering under the surface of Hollywood, but also by extension American society, and that if you select a few chosen sacrifices, that satisfies people with the feeling that deep sense of intuitive concern has been answered in some way, but in actual fact it hasn't. So it's a kind of way to keep the lid on it by just turning the volume down a little bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly, and I mean, I kind of think that when you really get down to it, that's what, you know, a lot of the real fear from the establishment in regards to Trump is coming from. I think there's a concern essentially that he would be the kind of individual who would effectively burn the entire house down in the process of trying to make a couple of these sacrifices.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's kind of interesting because that really goes back to, at least as far as I'm aware, was the first really significant post-World War II sex scandal in the UK, and that was Profumo.
Yeah.
And that was, again, another series of events that both Corbelly and Roy Cohn were involved in.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of speculation about that, of course. I'm sure you might find, I don't know if you know this or not, but it seems like, what's his name, Lord Mountbatten?
Is that Mountbatten, yeah.
Mountbatten was actually the kind of pivotal figure behind the Ward Ring. Ward was very close to a journalist named Worley Carlton, something to that effect, who had a long-standing relationship with MI6, and he had served under Mountbatten during the Second World War, and he seems to have introduced Ward into this social circle that Mountbatten was a part of. Ward, of course, ended up procuring girls for elements within the society, and by the early 60s, it was really evident that sort of center of gravity had gone to Cliveden, the estate that was owned by the Astor family.
Yeah.
And it seems like there was an attempt to launch various honey traps there. Of course, the Soviets were also involved in this. You had Ivanov, who was, you know, eventually one of the three people who kind of led to the scandal coming out, along with John Profumo and Christine Keeler. There was, of course, allegations that Ivanov might have been using Keeler to pump information from Profumo or vice versa.
Mm.
Also, Anthony, what was his name? Anthony Blunt, I believe. Yes, he was also a member of this scene and whatnot. Mm. And it seems like at some point the Americans became very, very concerned about this, and for obvious reasons. I mean, it does seem like the Soviets had infiltrated these circles for years up to this point and may well have been in possession of some very damaging information. So they dispatched Corbelly, or I don't know if they necessarily dispatched him, but Corbelly ends up in the UK in 62, I believe, and deliberately goes to seek out a relationship with Ward. He had apparently heard two rumors about Ward leading up to the time that he arrived in the UK. One was that Ward had been used as an unofficial back channel by the UK government to the Soviet government during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the second and more interesting rumor was that John F. Kennedy had also slept with one of the women in Ward's ring. Corbelly ended up defending Ward, becoming a good friend of his, and he does seem to have uncovered information that Kennedy was, in fact, involved in this ring.
Hmm. Was that when, sorry to interrupt, was that when Kennedy was in London then?
Yeah, actually, no. I believe several of the women that Ward, that were involved in Ward's ring had actually gone to New York City in 1960.
Okay. Well, the reason I asked was because apparently Kennedy was a student at the London School of Economics.
Yes. Now, I believe this would have been shortly after he had been elected, but before he was inaugurated, essentially. So anyway, Kennedy seems like he was ensnared in this ring. Corbelly found out about it. He returned to New York, and he starts telling Roy Cohn about this. Cohn was, of course, his attorney, so on the one hand, that makes sense, but Cohn would go on to essentially become Corbelly's point man with the FBI, and a lot of what Cohn told the FBI, as my understanding is, it's still classified to this day, ironically.
Wow.
But I do think there was a lot of concern about this because, I mean, just in general, if it had gotten out that Kennedy was involved in this, you know, sex ring that had potentially been penetrated by Soviet intelligence, I mean, it would have toppled, you know, American society, really. I mean, it would have just been utterly devastating, and I've seen this, you know, put forward as one of the reasons why Kennedy was ultimately assassinated. Of course, the Profumo ring was exposed, I believe, in June or July of 1963, not very long before the assassination. I don't think that it was the sole reason that he was assassinated, but certainly it was potentially a contributing factor for the assassination. Again, as I, you know, had just gone through saying, I mean, if this had come out, it would have been just devastating, I mean, both to the United States and probably to the UK. Of course, you guys did lose your prime minister over this, Howard Macmillan. But, I mean, if it had gone up to the president of the United States, I mean, it really, really would have, I think, decimated the whole NATO alliance, potentially, if you really want to get down to it. And this was, you know, a situation where Corbelly and Cohn were at the forefront of this, and these were, you know, the guys who really made Donald Trump as a political figure. And I'm sure that the people who are aware of this history, you know, have this in the back of their minds.
Hmm. And is there any evidence that, or was there, or is there, that the Profumo sex ring included children?
Yes and no. I have been able to determine that several of the women were minors. When they had started working in it, they were around 17, 16, but I don't know if Ward had deliberately recruited them knowing that they were minors, though. My understanding is that quite a few of the women had come from the countryside to London, you know, to make their fortunes, essentially. They had ended up working as strippers, and from there, Ward had recruited them. It's quite possible Ward was not aware that they were minors. I'm guessing that at least some of these women had lied about their age to, you know, begin working as sex workers in the first place.
Sure.
But there's no dispute that he definitely targeted younger women who probably could pass for being minors.
Hmm. Well, because you mentioned Mountbatten, and I don't know if you're familiar with the Kinkora Boys' School in Ireland. That was a notorious child brothel, it's not the right term for it, but a location for child sexual abuse and trafficking. Mountbatten was tied to that. And also Mountbatten was the person who introduced Jimmy Savile to the royal family, which, of course, you know, could just be a minor detail. I don't want to overstate it by just putting it in such an inflammatory context. But, you know, whatever, you know, where the smoke, there does tend to be fire with these things. And what I map in the Vice of Kings, or one of the main areas I look at, come back to, is during the 60s, the Jimmy Savile Cray twins nexus of child trafficking, which was Haute de Garenne on Jersey Island, and the Elm Guest House in Barnes in London, and who knows how many other places, and in Islington later on in the 70s. But there seems no doubt that Jimmy Savile was involved in procuring children for high-level elites, which may or may not have included the royal family. And so the Profumo affair, yeah, same place, same time, same basic elements, including Mountbatten. Just not, as you said, there's no absolute clear evidence to children, but it seems as though we're talking about the same basic function, in two obvious ways, as in providing illicit sex for the elite, whatever they want, right? There's got to be an all-inclusive menu, and using it for blackmail, and of course for honeypots to control people, you know, before or as they're being implemented in positions of power. And, you know, logically, the more forbidden the vices that they can be lured into, the more control can be wielded over those individuals. So it seems as though children, I mean, that's kind of like the ultimate bargaining chip in that regard.
Well, yeah, no question. I mean, if it comes out that you're, you know, abusing children, you're screwed.
That's the end of it, right?
Yes, no, I had actually wanted to get into, was it Kinkora Boys School? Is that how it's pronounced?
Yeah.
Okay. So, yes, because that was one of the things from reading your book and doing some of my, you know, looking, comparing it and contrasting it with some of the figures that had come up, was really interesting to me. From what I can tell, the first time inclinations of Kinkora were leaked to the public occurred, I believe, in either the late 60s or the early 70s. And this was sort of a part of this attempt, essentially, to put a really conservative government in control of the UK that was finally realized with the election of Thatcher, but this was a few years beforehand. But based on some of my research, one of the first figures to really leak information about this was a military intelligence officer named Colin Wallace. Hmm. And Wallace, during this time, was working for an organization known as the Information Research Department in the Foreign Office. Are you familiar with the IRD?
No.
It was essentially a propaganda outfit that had been created by the British government in the aftermath of the Second World War, and it was very, very secretive because it was essentially in league with much of the press at the time. But the IRD actually seems to have been the agency that had taken the first step towards leaking some of this, and initially it actually seems like they were interested in removing Edward Heath as the top figure in the Conservative Party. And this was where some of the allegations came out initially, that Heath was a homosexual and that also he had been abusing children. And my understanding is there has been compelling evidence, certainly in recent years, that's come out that Heath was a homosexual and to a lesser extent that he was a pedophile. But yeah. Anyway, a major figure for the IRD who I've written a lot on was a man named Brian Crozier. Crozier would eventually become the chairman of the Socialist Complex in the 1980s, and he seems to have been a significant figure in British intelligence for a number of years. By the 1970s, he had created an institution known as the Institute for the Study of Conflict, which was essentially a propaganda outfit that disseminated a lot of anti-communist propaganda and so on and so forth. Now, Crozier had actually come to the attention of labor during the 1970s, essentially because they had become aware that he was being subsidized by the IRD for some of these projects that he were involved in that were very sketchy. And ironically, the figure who eventually brought Crozier to task in front of Parliament was David Owen.
Oh, right, right.
So I know you've written quite extensively. For those of you who are not familiar with this, Owen was a Fabian socialist. Mm. And
I was just going to interject Jimmy Savile again, that he was the one who gave Jimmy Savile the keys to Broadmoor, which was the mental institution for young girls primarily, and Jimmy Savile just had free access to that for his sexual predations, and maybe also to bring other people in there again as an unofficial child brothel disguised as a mental institution. So yeah, David Owen was definitely complicit with that. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so Owen launched an investigation based on what Crozier was doing. Actually, the investigation had originally been overseen by Anthony Crossland. I believe that's how it's pronounced. I remember you also listed him as a Fabian, right?
Who is it again?
Anthony Crossland, C-R-O-S-L-A-N-D?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, but anyway, Owen eventually took over, and due to the revelations concerning the IRD subsidizing Crozier, Owen was the one who moved to shut down the IRD, the same agency that had been leaking, the initial allegations about the boys' school and pedophilia allegations from there,
right.
Which I thought was very interesting. But even more interesting to my mind is the fact that Crozier, of course, was very opposed to the Labor Party. He saw it as being absolutely riddled with communists, and to this end, he had gone to great lengths to try to essentially take down the Labor Party and remove it from power because of this. Hmm. However, Crozier actually believed that Owens was a staunch anti-communist and was one of the few reliable people in labor. Hmm. And my understanding is that even though the IRD was officially shut down, it essentially was rechristened by a different name and, shuffled off into a different, section of the government, and it continued its functions. So it kind of raises the possibility, was Owen actually engaged in some kind of cover-up over this?
Right, it does indeed. Didn't he, I think he went on to found his own party, David Owen, didn't he? The Social Democrats.
Yes, he did, and that's, is another interesting connection to Crozier. In his autobiography, Free Agent, Brian Crozier alleges that he was actually the driving force behind the foundation of this party. It grew out of an organization called the Social Democratic Alliance. Crozier was very friendly with the two co-founders of it, Douglas Eden and an individual named Stephen Hassler. Anyway, Crozier suggested to these two individuals that they should turn the SDA into a full-blown party that could rival labor, and he was also the one who suggested that they should approach Roy Jenkins to head this party.
Okay, all right. So there's Roy Jenkins then, because you mentioned him also.
Yes, yes, yes. And apparently Crozier had done this specifically because he wanted to divide the labor vote in 1983 so that Thatcher would be reelected, which, is my understanding, was effectively what had happened.
Hmm. Okay. So Jenkins, I don't know how much you looked into him, and I don't know a great deal. I mean, one of my problems is a lot of these characters and these things I only found out while writing Vice of Kings, and then, and that, you know, so I just found out whatever I included in there, and then I forget it. I tend to forget it. But one thing I do remember about Roy Jenkins is that I mean, he was generally seen over several decades as one of the most progressive politicians out there, and that he pushed various different agendas, obviously not single-handedly, but he was something of a figurehead. I think David Marquand in his obituary said that he'd changed the face of British society more than any other single individual, or something along those lines. And the way that he changed it was mostly in these apparently progressive ways, in terms of tolerance for homosexuality, lighter sentences for prisoners, you know, eliminating the death penalty, or making sure that the death penalty wasn't restored, or and so on. You know, generally things that we associate with good, solid values, right? And yet, behind that, it seems as though the interests that he was serving were anything but beneficial to the general populace. I mean, they seem to have a covert agenda, which of course is what we're talking about here. You know, is that on the one hand we've got the public face of politics, and the policies and the different ideologies, and well, they seem to be progressive or regressive or whatever, according to our own limited perspective of them. But behind the scenes, what you're describing here is an entirely different agenda. It's more like an espionage agenda, right?
Well, yes, absolutely. And it's interesting, too, because Crozier notes that he actually went to great lengths to hide his involvement in this party from both Owen and Jenkins.
Oh.
Because if they had known that he was pushing it, they would have never agreed to it,
Oh,
actually.
okay. So, right. So that's interesting. So then they would have been, to some degree, unaware of the function that they were
Yes,
serving.
that they were being used for. And I seem to remember in Vice of Kings, you had suggested that Jennings or Owens had both played a key role in New Labour, I think, when Blair came to power.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So, and to me, that was really interesting because, I mean, Crozier was, you know, extremely right-wing. I mean, he was, like I said before, chairman of Le Socle, which was really the Bilderberg, essentially, of the far right for many years. It may well still be. And yet he was here pushing these two Fabian socialists, Owens and Jenkins, and to create this new party, which my understanding had also eventually influenced the Tony Blair version of the Labour Party, which seems to have taken it in a much more, you know, pro-capitalist, pro-imperialist direction, if anything else.
Absolutely, yeah. And as I recall, the Social Democrat Party, which I grew up, you know, it was coming into being when I was growing up, so I was aware of it just because of my family and whatnot. It didn't ever really take off. It was never really seriously in the running as a third party. So maybe it was more of a sort of paving the way for the New Labour. I guess that's exactly what you just said, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, it's really interesting. And another point I found out about Crozier that I thought you might find interesting too was his opposition to the campaign for nuclear disarmament. I know that was you know, a topic that's very dear to you. I believe was it your brother who was involved in it, or?
No, it was my grandfather. He was one of the founding members. Yeah. Yeah.
So, Crozier actually had set up an organization. I believe it was known as the Coalition for Peace Through Security. Yes, the Coalition for Peace Through Security. And this was also a group that was affiliated with the American Coalition Peace Through Strength, which had been developed by the American Security Council. The ASC was a big right-wing organization in the U.S. that had a lot of very powerful generals and intelligence officers in it. But I don't want to get too much into the ASC because that's a Byzantine topic in and of itself. But anyway, Crozier had helped set up the Coalition for Peace Through Security, and essentially it had been designed to target the campaign for nuclear disarmament. One of the figures in it was a man named Julian Lewis, who eventually became a Tory MP. He was also involved in this private intelligence network that Crozier had set up, known as the Sixth Eye, in the 1980s. And curiously, he had engaged in several lawsuits with a magazine called Scallywag, I believe, in the early 90s, which had uncovered evidence of pedophilia amongst both Labour and the Tories. He had managed to get hold of these files, and he had essentially essentially used it to disseminate information on labor in the years afterwards while suppressing any of the information he found on the Tories. And another big figure in the Coalition for Peace through Security was a man named Edward Lee, who eventually became a member of the Knights of Malta. He was involved in the Sixth Eye with Crozier and Lewis. And curiously, more recently, he became a business partner with a man named Duncan Breeze, who was convicted of possessing thousands of pornographic images of children, I believe, in this decade. I think it actually even brought him into Parliament or something to that effect.
It brought him into Parliament?
Yeah, I think he had meetings with him in Parliament or something to that effect. I would have to go back and look that up, but certainly it was surprising that an MP would bring in this guy who was convicted of, you know, possessing pornographic material of children, or certainly to go into business with him, especially since this was a Tory we're talking about, too.
Right. Right.
And another connection, this didn't involve Crozier, but involved with another member of the Circular Complex, what was his name? Lord Chalfont, I believe? He had been a Labour MP, if I remember correctly, and he had been...
What was the name, sir?
Lord Chalfont, C-H-A-L-F-O-N-T.
Yeah, it doesn't ring a bell.
Yes, I don't remember you writing about him, but Chalfont had become a big guy in Circular Complex by the late 70s, early 80s. He had become involved with a private detective agency in the 1980s known as Zeus Security, I believe. And Zeus Security had been hired to run a lot of operations against the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament and a lot of these other anti-nuclear organizations that were active in Britain during the 1980s. And essentially, they had subcontracted to a couple of different detective agencies, and eventually the agency they had ended up hiring to essentially carry out these operations in the field was run by a man named Victor Norris, who had actually founded a satanic temple in the UK. He was also involved with several neo-Nazi groups, and he was also a convicted sex offender. I've been trying to find information on this, but it seems that he had effectively pimped out his underage daughter in the early 70s, which had led to his incarceration. And this was the man that was essentially tasked with infiltrating a lot of the you know, CNP activists and other, you know, like-minded groups during the 1980s.
The CND.
Yes, the CND, yes. A satanic Nazi who had been convicted of pedophilia.
Thank you.
Right, and we've got the triad of interest there, haven't we? The intelligence, well, Nazi, not quite, but I mean, the intelligence, the occultism, and the child sexual abuse. And it seems, I mean, my impression, and actually I was also going to mention earlier when we were talking about Mountbatten and the Profumo scandal, and that it's also, oh, you mentioned Anthony Blunt, well, this also ties it to Crowley, albeit in an earlier period, because it seems as though Crowley's function as an occultist working in British intelligence, or at least one of the ways that there might have been an overlap between those two interests, as in being an agent for intelligence and being an occultist, was that he would have these parties at which he would have these sexual rituals and then take photographs, right? And then he would use those photographs to blackmail the participants. Now, this is kind of reported by Crowley biographers, if at all, as a, you know, a personal peccadillo on the part of Crowley. I don't think anyone's implied before I did that he might have actually been, you know, just following SOP for British
staging
intelligence. Staging honey traps and building up a file. So one of the, because I'm always looking for kind of unified theories or just a way to simplify it rather than be endlessly wading through all the different data points. So one of the things I wonder is, you know, when did this begin? Like, at what point did occult fraternities become intelligence agencies or vice versa, right? You know, which came first there? And at what point did child trafficking, child pornography, child sexual abuse, honey traps relating to children become standard operating procedure for those? Because there's a weird, obviously there's a correlation, I mean, there's a weird confusion or a conflation between elite who simply want to have sex with children and elite who also want to traffic children to create honey traps to control other elite, right? Which comes first there, no? And then there's the sort of the factor that people who have been sexually abused as children are much more likely to grow up with a pathology around that. They're much more susceptible to temptation because of that trauma. So then there's that. And then there's the thing with occultism, and there seems to be a correlation between occultism and traumatic rituals and early sexualization of children, or if we're just going to call a spade, you know, sexually abusing children. So it's a whole, you know, complex there of different social trends and human pathologies and strategies and historical currents and so on. So how is it possible, do you think, to pick them apart and to I mean, have you attempted this at all to try and trace it back to its origins?
No, I mean, I've mostly, just because, I mean, of the, you know, just complexity of everything that the focus happened in the Cold War, that's usually been where my, you know, focus has been, and not going back beyond that point. But certainly right. That would be something that at some point I do want to explore. It's just been purely just trying to map out, I mean, some of the more recent occurrences of this, and then potentially going back even further.
Right. So you haven't even speculated in terms of,
I mean, how far back it goes, no. I mean, I don't. I mean, I suppose an argument could be made to maybe even go back as far as John Dee, at least. Who knows?
or ancient Greece.
Certainly. I mean, yes, definitely. The elites of ancient Greece were quite known, I mean, for their practice of pedophilia.
Yeah, well, pederasty more often. But,
yeah.
I mean, certainly in terms of sexual abuse traumatizing children and the adults growing up with those complexes, that's been going on, you know, for time immemorial. At what point did different groups become aware of that and that it could be consciously implemented would be one, you know, obviously significant question there. Obviously, we've got somebody like Machiavelli, who acts very much like an intelligence operative from what we know about him. I'm sure there are countless other examples. History is not my strong point. Have you researched or speculated about that? Like, when what we now think of as intelligence agencies and espionage, how far we could trace back things in history that are more or less equivalent to that?
I mean, I think at least in the Western experience, the first, at least that I'm aware of, true intelligence agency in this sort of, you know, capacity you're talking about with an almost global scale would have been Praetorian Guard from ancient Rome. Of course, the CIA is often itself referred to Praetorian Guard for that reason. I mean, we usually tend to think of the Praetorians as more of a military force, and to some extent they were. They were, of course, you know, responsible for the personal security of the emperor. But a big part of what they did, essentially, was to keep tabs on the emperor's enemies, to disseminate black propaganda against the, you know, enemies of the emperor and that type of thing. And definitely that, I think, would have been, you know, one of the first cornerstones of Western intelligence.
And did they have, as far as you know, did they have any occult ideology?
Well, I mean, almost inevitably. I mean, especially, you know, after the rise of Mithraism, you know, I mean, quite, I mean, this was actually, you know, an ideology that was very prominent within the legions themselves. If I'm not mistaken, that was how Mithras had really spread to the Roman Empire, was through the legionaries who encountered it in Syria and places like that. I think there's a strong chance that this would have been the, you know, case with the Praetorians as well.
And you say you never really dabbled in the occult yourself, like it never had an interest for you in terms of how it tends to attract people in terms of self-empowerment or self-transformation or any of that?
No, not really. No, honestly, I'm kind of frightened, honestly, of trying to dabble in the occult. Generally speaking, it does not seem like it ends well, no matter, you know, how pure your intentions may be going into it, which is why I tend to think the best remedy is to just avoid participating in it at all.
Right, well, that's certainly what I testify to in Vice of Kings after many, many years immersing in it. So what's your view then of... and because it's quite prevalent, I would say, I mean, in your field, I mean, you might be quite unique in your field in terms of, I mean, there's quite a few researchers into deep politics and whatnot who are Christian, and of course they would be opposed to the occult. But probably I would guess that most who are involved in research have a kind of sympathy for the occult.
Yeah, I mean, I could definitely see that. I mean, in the States in general, it actually seems, though, like a lot more of the researchers here were typically fundamentalist Christians. I could see how that would not have, you know, been the case in the UK. But I would essentially say I'm not necessarily anti-pagan, but I'm not, you know, necessarily pro-Christian either. I mean, certainly one of my areas of expertise has been chronicling Christian cults and, you know, their manipulation and uses by the deep state and so on and so forth. And then certainly when you get into some of these very old and very reactionary Catholic orders like the Knights of Malta, and then a more recent one would be Opus Dei. I mean,
well, they seem like occult fraternities themselves.
Well, yes,
don't
yes, yes. I mean, to some extent it could be argued that, yes, I mean, they are, but I mean, certainly through a Christian lens, I mean, I think many of these, you know, people involved in this type of stuff from that, you know, perspective would probably consider themselves to be Christian mystics first and foremost. And, you know, that's really something that's a little different, I think, between occultism in the U.S. and the U.K. versus on continental Europe, of course. Especially in France, Martinism was very influential, which had been led, or at least the modern manifestation had been led and created by Papists towards the end of the late 19th, early 20th century. And my understanding is that Papus first and foremost considered himself to be a Christian mystic rather than an occultist or a pagan. So I think that in some capacity, at least, there was a rationalization in that regard, that this was actually, you know, being done through a Christian framework as opposed to some kind of pagan one. But certainly, I mean, these groups are also exposed to a lot of this type of ideology. And then, of course, in the case of Opus Dei, I've, you know, uncovered evidence that they were deeply involved in some of the pedophile networks in Europe, especially in Belgium. And this is also true of the Knights of Malta, for that matter, as well. So I guess what I would say is that, you know, I see the flaws of both the Christians and the pagans in that regard. I mean, both ideologies have been manipulated, to put it mildly.
Sure, yeah. And what's your view then, because I can see how you wouldn't want to write about this generally because you can't stick with the facts, but what's your view personally in terms of the metaphysical aspect, if any, in social control and espionage and occult fraternities? Do you think that there is a mystical element or a supernatural element or whatever we're going to call it that's also a factor in all of this? Or do you just
Yes, leave, I mean, yeah, no, I mean, I definitely think there's a real possibility of that. I mean, beyond question. And that kind of, you know, going back to our discussions, was there actually a meta group? Were there different factions? Well, I mean, it also could be taken up to an even higher level. Well, I mean, is it a spiritual war? Are there different, you know, factions on this level as well that are also competing for the hearts and minds of humanity?
Mm-hmm. So, but you just, is that something you speculate about privately and that you would consider writing about, or is it just something you leave kind of as an unknown and a not need to know basis?
But yeah, at this point, I don't know that I would really want to, I mean, write on that kind of topic. I mean, certainly at this point, especially trying to get the book up and off the ground, I mean, I'm trying to focus on things that I can actually prove. But I mean, it is, you know, a fascinating topic, and I mean, I do think there's a dimension to that, and at some point I may well delve into it, because I mean, at the forefront, I think when you kind of discuss about the possible, you know, divides between the ideologies of, you know, mages as like Crowley and Evoli, I think at the end of the day, there is a spiritual component to this division. Certainly in the case of Crowley, who, you know, if I'm not mistaken, saw himself as an avatar for a new age of stellar religion, and refers to Evoli, who saw his mission essentially to bring about the end of the current age, to bring a return to a traditional solar mythology.
Hmm. Okay, interesting juxtaposition. I mean, not to get pulled into this rabbit hole, but Crowley's Book of the Law certainly has a solar phallic deity in there with Horus, but it also has Newt as the night sky and every man and woman is a star, etc., and that's clearly a feminine thing. But I mean, in simple terms, he was profulgating a synthesis of matriarchy and patriarchy into synarchy, I guess, but into the child, the reign of the child.
And that was really in contrast to Evoli, of course. Evoli essentially considered women to be just soulless entities, more or less.
But Crowley did personally, actually. If you look at Crowley's personal...
Yes. No, I know. Crowley did certainly, yes, have very low opinion and treatment of women as well. There's no question of that. But I, at least in terms of his ideology, though, I think he at least attempted to acknowledge the divine feminine, whereas Evolan ideology is almost based around the destruction of the divine feminine, you know, essentially to destroy the feminine within one's soul to achieve a pure form of enlightenment, more or less.
Hmm. There's a line in one of the Gnostic texts, which is supposedly Christ saying, "I come to destroy the works of the female, the works of the feminine." Which, I'm just throwing that out there. It's been a while since I've referred to those texts, but...
Yes, no, I mean, it's certainly interesting, and I mean, I know you had speculated about the, you know, use of physical violence and Crowley's approach to sex magic, but there's no real question that Evoli seems to have embraced this. Of course, the researcher Kevin Coogan rather humorously referred to his concept of sex magic as the metaphysics of the whip, being because Evoli essentially argued more or less that you could raise the condyla, was it the Kundalini?
Yeah.
Kundalini forces by inflicting physical abuse on the female form. The example he gave was through whippings, essentially.
Yeah. Right. Well, I think Crowley, by his own espousal, was more of a masochist. And his sex magic was primarily homosexual, I think, not that he excluded women. Of course, he tried everything, but I think his predilection was for homosexual sex magic, specifically, you know, sodomy. So that we could say that's a kind of violence, I suppose.
Yes.
And certainly for raising the Kundalini. I mean, that's, I think it's a bad idea all around, actually.
Yeah. Well, certainly, I mean, take the approach of some of these people. I mean, especially, I mean, when you're essentially advocating that, I mean, inflicting harm on another human being can, I mean, raise a higher state of being. It's appalling.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that idea, I mean, that's what I explore in, I also explore it in Vice of Kings, but more thoroughly in Prisoner Infinity, specifically because it's entering, I don't know if it's quite right to call it the mainstream, but certainly more mainstream and more kind of effetely respectable than dark occultism via somebody like Jeffrey Kripal, who's promoting Whitley Strieber, and this notion that I've called trauma genesis, which is that inflicting trauma can bring about enlightenment. Now, he's not actually going as far as somebody like Evelyn Crowley saying we should traumatize people to enlighten them, but it's the thin end of the wedge because he's saying that these people who have been traumatized have become enlightened because of it, which I think is equally questionable.
No, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, because it's maybe a thin end of the transhumanist wedge in respect to this disembodiment thing. Because if we're actually harming the body, traumatizing the body, putting toxins in the body, and affective trauma memory, and so on, then any kind of enlightenment or pseudo enlightenment would have to be at the cost of the body and uncoupled from the body. So then that suggests a dissociative state, I would say.
No, I mean, definitely. I could definitely see how, that would play out. I mean, of course, it seems like it was, at least in Evola's system, somewhat different in that I think his form of enlightenment actually came from inflicting pain on others, whereas as opposed to having pain inflicted upon his person or.
Gotcha, right. So he was feeding off the energy or
Yes,
something like that.
essentially the energy of, I mean, inflicting pain on another human being, their suffering, essentially.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty dark.
Of course, it's disturbing to think that this is, I mean, the kind of spiritual enlightenment a lot of the rulers are looking towards.
A lot of who, sorry?
A lot of the rulers of the various nations of the earth right now.
Yeah. I think it trickles down to the people as well. Like I say, I mean, as many, probably most of the researchers in the field that we're exploring, certainly many of them, as I said, they have a orientation towards occultism. It's just so prevalent now. I think that's one of the unacknowledged dangers of having a psychopathic elite, if we're going to use that term at all, and I think that's oversimplifying, but anyway, is that their behaviors and their pathologies trickle down to us.
No, absolutely. I mean, when this is kind of the foundation of, I mean, the civilization that's, built around, I mean, cruelty, the abuse of children. I mean, I mean, there's no question that it's going to have an effect on everybody, more broadly speaking.
Yeah. So I did want to, I guess we'll wind up pretty quickly, but I did want to sort of go a bit meta. How do you feel that this research that you've dedicated so much time to and so many years and gone so deeply into, and as you said, it's kind of open-ended, so there's maybe no end in sight, but what are the ways that you find it for yourself personally useful?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think for, I mean, at least for me, it gave me, at least at the time when I really started to embark upon it, a purpose. I had really just been, drifting, I think, at this time in my kind of mid to late 20s. I didn't really know, what I was supposed to do with my life. And as I, gradually got into this and started to do this research, it kind of occurred to me that, something that I appeared to be good at and that gave me some meaning was to essentially be a teacher, more or less, because I do feel in some ways that's, part of what I'm trying to do with this research is to teach people. And that was, I guess, a positive development for me, and that later led to more fulfilling things. I mean, certainly in terms of just personal relationships, I'm now married as opposed to the last time I talked to you, and just in general, I'm.
Congratulations.
Thank you, thank you. Yes, no, I mean, I think it made me, I think, sort of this dedication to trying to do a higher good, trying to, I mean, enlighten people. It helped me on a personal level become somebody who was more capable of engaging upon a meaningful and fulfilling relationship with another person.
In what way would you say?
I just think in terms of being, it's hard to describe, but I just think realizing that you had to make sacrifices to make a relationship work. It can't, always be about you. It also has to be about the other person.
So you mean that you develop this awareness by looking so closely at social distortions and pathologies and the way not to do it? Or
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, it never really occurred to me, but yes, I think to some extent, yes, it just seems like that. I mean, a lot of occult doctrine is about the individual and the person and your own enlightenment, and it just seems like this is kind of, you know, contrary to the natural way of human beings interacting with one another. I mean, to have stable families, to have stable, you know, societies, I mean, since they're all kind of interrelated, you have to be willing to sacrifice for one another.
Right. So yeah, I mean that makes good sense to me. It does also raise the same question in a new way, which is that if you found, but I mean I think you touched on it in this last point, but if you found collating this data and arranging it as a way to communicate with others has been very helpful for you, and that it's made you feel that you were serving, providing a public service, let's say. I'm running a thrift store now, so I've got a very visceral sense of what that's like, you know, outside of writing, but I definitely aspired to that as a writer too. But of course, for that to be true and for us to really experience it, we would have to believe in or hopefully know that what we're providing or what we're offering in our writing is going to be useful to other people. So then the question comes up again, right? How do you feel that it's useful for other people to know about the hidden machinations of their society?
Well, I mean, I think just in general, I mean, if we're going to, you know, reform society into a more positive construct, I mean, we have to understand what's currently guiding it. And I mean, not just, you know, the individuals, the organizations, but as you're kind of hinting at, also the spiritual forces as well, because that's, I think, definitely a dimension of it as well. So, and I do think, I mean, that's, you know, I mean, one of the positive things, at least that I've tried to do and hopefully have accomplished with my writing, is to, you know, try to present, you know, compelling data to people without a lot of editorialization so that they can themselves make informed opinions, ones that they hopefully have come to through their own, you know, conclusions, their own soul searching, that type of thing. And I suppose in a sense, you know, I'm trying to empower people in that, you know, I'm providing them with information about these, you know, obscure and arcane topics that can frankly be very expensive to research when left to your own devices, and hopefully, you know, they can take this raw data and they, you know, can take the next step and draw their own conclusions from it, and in the process, you know, grow as individuals themselves.
Well, for myself, and I think you're hinting at the same thing perhaps, that what I've found is that there's a correlation between doing what I do in terms of sorting the seeds or sifting through the facts of social history, culture, and my own past. There's a correlation between that and the psychological or psychoanalytical process of self-examination and, you know, sorting the seeds of one's past to find out who we are, to bring it back to your dream. And so I personally found the work, to me, as it's evolved, because I don't think it was this for me in the early days. I think I was falling into the trap of conspiratainment and just, you know, endlessly stimming that nerve that just wants to kind of frighten itself or titillate itself with how dark the world is. But I think over time, it became more and more about really trying to find the ground of being, you know, in the world, and that's my sense of what you're doing, and from speaking to you, that it's helped you find the ground, and that then potentially you're modeling that to other people as well.
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, I also, you know, would say that it's very much been a process of self-discovery for me. I mean, especially some of the implications it has for my background, and, you know, my hope is that it will also encourage self-discovery in other individuals who encounter my research. Because, I mean, really, that's, you know, I think what it's all about, you know, we have to continue, each and every one of us, to grow and develop as people.
Yeah, well, that's my sense about society, too. And again, like working in a small community, it's become more experiential. But that I don't personally think that we need to remake society. I think we need to rediscover the true society that already exists, just as we have a true self underneath all this cultural gunk and this trauma and this ideological mind control. there's a true essence of who we are. I think that's true of us as a human collective too. It's there already. And so the more we can see the distortions that are overlaid on top of it, the more we can start to see what's behind those distortions.
Well, absolutely. It kind of goes back to the old adage, know thyself.
Yeah. Do you get many emails, personal emails about your work?
Yes. I do get a fair amount of them. I mean, well, not a lot, but the nice thing about it, though, is usually they're very, you know, insightful emails. That's actually one of the reasons why I'm a little slow to respond to them, just because, I mean, these, you know, people send me just these wonderful, you know, long-form emails with lots of interesting information and personal experiences in it. And,
right.
You know, I feel obligated to try to, you know, respond with something in equal measures to them. You know, I just don't want to give them, like, a one- or two-sentence response, which is one of the reasons why there can be a delay for me responding to you. But, I mean, that's definitely one of the more fulfilling aspects of this, is to find, you know, somebody who was really moved by the blog and who took the time to really write an insightful email to me about it.
Mm. Right, so that's like you're attracting collaborators.
Even. Yes. I mean, I would say, in a sense, you know, I've encountered a lot of interesting individuals and who have also kind of helped further my research through some of the information that they've sent to me or for some of the things that they've told me.
Right. Yeah, well, one of the things that I've noticed, and the reason I asked, is that although people who write to me, they often do appreciate the work I'm doing in terms of analysis and so on and so forth, what they're often expressing more is that it's helped them to feel less alone in their own lives, like they've found a kind of personal sense of affinity in exploring my work that I would say transcends just the mere facts that I'm presenting.
Well, yes, I mean, obviously, I mean, I think it's always, you know, gratifying when you find out that you're not the only person who's kind of, you know, had some of these same questions, and there are other people out there that are also asking them. I mean, there's no question, you know, it's a great feeling.
Yeah, because we don't get that by hanging around InfoWars, you know?
Or, I mean, you know, the local sports bar or anything of that nature either. So.
Well, yeah, of course, but I mentioned InfoWars again because even if there might be thousands of people out there who have apparently similar interests, it's the medium and the message, isn't it? The way that they're engaging with the material is just not equivalent.
Yes, it's not a constructive way of researching this, or activism, or really anything constructive for that matter. I mean, Jesus, just look at, I mean, how Alex Jones, you know, I mean, carries on. I mean, I half expect the man to have a heart attack in the middle of one of his broadcasts, you know.
I think that's what people tune in for. I mean, not to see him have
a heart
attack.
Yeah, I know, and it's, you're almost like watching, I mean, a mentally disturbed man, you know, drag himself into an early grave. Yes, it's not something that you're going to see any kind of enlightenment out of, to put it mildly.
No, yeah, just the opposite. And yeah, my impression, and I've tried to kind of strengthen this signal and to follow it by noticing it. But my impression of the people that I reach is, as we're just circling around, that it's people who are trying to discover the truth of themselves. Yeah, they're not just looking for endless information or factoids. It's just part of a much larger journey to find out the truth of ourselves, and that's,
I think that makes perfect sense, just because of the nature of a lot of this, you know, material, and I mean how dark and unsettling a lot of it is. I mean, I do think that on some level you have to have a personal investment to go to the lengths that, you know, people like us have, and I mean our followers, our readers, and that type of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Which is very central for me, was at a certain point I realized, well, I started to question, why am I so fascinated by, why am I endlessly drawn to look at the dark? And at that point, rather than turn away, because I knew I couldn't do that, I might have tried a couple of times, I started to include that question. Why am I drawn to this material? That's the thing I want to find out. And that was when it really started to change, because I started to, once I opened a space for the possibility that there was actually a deeper unconscious reason I was drawn to it, in my own life or in my own body, then the process became more conscious. It's become progressively more conscious.
No, I mean, I would definitely agree with that. It's been a very similar experience for me as well.
Hmm. Well, I look forward to if and when you do include your own personal history. As I say, I know it's a threshold that one doesn't want to cross prematurely, but if and when you do, I'll be doubly interested in hearing about that.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think it would be kind of an interesting topic.
Yeah, I'm sure it would. I mean, once it's referenced in the personal, a whole new dimension opens up. You know, for listeners as well as or readers as well as for oneself. Is part of your concern about crossing the threshold that it involves living family members?
Not so much that, no. It's just more mainly I just really want more information on this potential topic specifically before I really try to analyze it, because at this point the only references I've found have been debatable of reliability, I guess I would say. I mean, again, I'm kind of a stickler for source material, and I'm looking for more credible source material before I can really get into some of these experiences.
Gotcha. Yeah, well, I am. I'm an Aries. If astrology means anything to you, and Aries, we're fools who rush in where angels know better, and I pretty much did that with Occult Yorkshire and Vice of Kings. I was just like, in for a penny, in for a pound, you know, I'm going to... I knew it was risky, and I have alienated some of my larger family, but we were never really close anyway, so I don't know if there's any real consequences there. I recently had my Wikipedia page taken down for no apparent reason, so that's possibly family related, I don't know, but at a certain point the pressure for me got too intense, the pressure of keeping silent, right, because I felt as though I'd actually been conditioned to keep silence about this my whole life, so I started blurting it out, and not literally, well, actually literally, because I have a podcast too, but in terms of the way I wrote Vice of Kings, there is a certain amount of blurting in there. There are areas that I do wonder, well, maybe I didn't really gather quite enough reliable data to create the picture that I'm creating, but anyway, I did it, so hopefully there won't be any too severe repercussions.
I mean, that's always the most you can hope for. But, I mean, again, you know, it's about the point is that you felt strongly that you needed to do it. And, I mean, I think that's really the important thing.
Yeah, although it could have been compulsive, but...
No, I mean, from what I've seen about your background, I could definitely see how, you know, you really needed to do a project like that to kind of come to terms with your past.
It's like... well, not doing penance, that would be putting it too dramatically, but asserting my difference from my background by speaking out against it. Yeah, becoming a class traitor is how my wife put it.
Or a collaborator or something to that effect.
I hear a voice that's not my own that tells me to jump into the sea. Tired of listening to these words, I know they aren't meant for me. I know they aren't meant for me. I won't listen.
My conversation with the reclusive one from Viceup. If you don't know Recluse's blog, I suggest you check it out. Follow the link in the show notes. There's some very thorough and rigorous analysis going on there. A rare oasis of sobriety within the field of conspiracy research. Next week's podcast will be number 200. I'm not entirely sure who it's going to be with, but I'm sure it will be wonderful. So tune in then, and in the meantime, keep supporting me if you want to. donations and other ways, comments, reviews for my books and so on. I'm going to set up pages at the website for the recent books so people can write reviews or just give feedback on the books there at the website in case they don't want to or can't use Amazon. Currently serializing a 8,000 word analysis of D.W. Pasulka's American Cosmic at the blog. That's called When Wonder Occludes Objectivity, or WOO for short. Check that out and participate with your comments and share it. Let people know, spread the word that there are alternate ways to understand what's going on beside the mainstream narratives. Let's deconstruct the counterfeit and break it down to its constituent parts. And I'm continuing to do Liminal Radio weekly, Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific time. You can find that linked at the website. This is Jason Horsley for The Liminalist, the podcast between the podcasts.
Anymore. These words.